Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Welcome to today's Council on Foreign Relations Corporate Roundtable with Danielle Noy, Chair of the Supervisory Board of the European Central Bank. Please completely turn off, not just put on vibrate, your electronic devices to avoid interference with the sound system or interruptions to our discussion. I'd like to remind everyone that this meeting is on the record. And please note that this meeting is being teleconferenced, audio only, to corporate members. And now I'd like to introduce our invited speaker, Danielle Noy. She is an entrepreneur of sorts in that she created the job she has now. She is the inaugural chair of the supervisory board, which came into force in November 2014. You started with it before early in 2014. So she oversees 123 of the biggest European lenders. She is a lifelong bank regulator. Starting at the very beginning of her career, she came up through the French bank regulatory system. And so she has 40 years of doing this under her belt. She has a reputation to protect, as she explained to me before the meeting, and that's why she's not going to let anything get by her. At this late stage in her career, this is not the time to suddenly get soft. So I'm going to give her 10 minutes or so to introduce herself to you. Then I'll ask some questions, and at 8:30 or so, we will throw it open to questions from our very knowledgeable audience. With that, Danielle Noy.
Thank you very much. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm pleased to speak to you today about the changing regulatory and supervisory landscape in Europe, and I look forward to a good discussion. Considering the significance of this day for the United States, and in particular for New York City, I'm very honored that you are attending this event. As you know, almost 1 year ago, the ECB took on the responsibility of supervising the 123 most important banking groups in the euro area as a direct result of the global financial crisis. The crisis exposed shortcomings and systemic weaknesses in regulation and supervision in the financial sector. While the US has many supervisory authorities with different specific responsibilities, but within the same jurisdiction, Europe had many supervisory authorities with similar responsibilities, but in different national jurisdictions. And that was problematic. Supervisory authorities stopped at national borders, but the operation of a bank would not. This structural weakness was exacerbated by the sovereign debt crisis. Banks were operating in a monetary union, but not in a banking union under unified supervision, resolution, and deposit guarantee schemes. The cost of any failure in this incongruent system was ultimately borne by taxpayers via the governments. The bank sovereign nexus was unsustainable and threatened our financial system and our economies, so it was clear that it needed to be eliminated. As a result, European policymakers agreed to the creation of the banking union, the rationale being to achieve a consistent euro area banking system independent from national bias. European banks should be judged on their own strengths and weaknesses. They should provide their own backstops for failure, and the same rules should apply. We are convinced that this will lead to banks being stronger and more resilient to crisis situations. The SSM was the first pillar of the banking union, which has to be completed by the single resolution mechanism effective in 2016 on the harmonization of deposit guarantee schemes. European banking supervision offers the unique opportunity to ensure that banking in a single currency area operates on a level playing field and plays a reliable and stable role in the economy. Of course, only 1 year in, this undertaking is to a certain extent still work in progress. But I would say that it is already working very well. Let me give you some specific examples. When the ECB's supervision mandate under the name of Single Supervisory Mechanism, or SSM in short, became operational last November, we had just completed the comprehensive assessment of the 130 most significant banks of the euro area, most of which we then began to supervise directly. This gave us a head start for the subsequent work. Following the comprehensive assessment, we closely monitor the implementation of remedial actions for the 25 banks with capital shortfalls, and we completed the annual supervisory assessment of the banks, which results in the determination of individual bank capital requirements to the Pillar 2 that have to be met by these banks. Because we were only about 2 months into operation, November, this first assessment round was performed in the ECB in 2014, mostly based on the methodology formally applied by the national supervisors. But I am pleased to say that the 2015 round to be implemented in 2016 is done under a unified methodology that was explicitly developed by us in the ECB. This exercise is already showing the impact of a more harmonized approach to banking supervision. Of course, we do not start from scratch, and we are not reinventing the wheel regarding supervision. We pinpointed best practices on which we then modeled our final outcome. And we employ this approach to many of the issues we are facing to achieve our ultimate objective of level playing field for banking across Europe. What helps immensely in this harmonization task is the whole setup of the SSM. We are about 800 supervisors in the ECB, plus 200 people in support services, with expertise and experience in the field of regulation and supervision from the public and private sector. We are working hand in glove with the national supervisors, who are directly supervising the remaining 3,500 banks, and are implementing the supervisory guidance on best practices that we agreed to on a European level. That means that in addition to our staff in Frankfurt, we are drawing on another 2,000 supervisory staff in the 19 euro area countries. We therefore benefit from the national experience and expertise of the local supervisors. At the same time, the fact that supervisory policy decisions are made at the European level guarantees the absence of political influence on national capture. We are devoted to tough supervision. We strive to be fair and even-handed in our actions while avoiding a one-size-fits-all supervision approach. By balancing uniform supervisory anchor points with constrained supervisory judgment, we ensure both consistency across institutions and tailored supervision to bank-specific circumstances. One of the major assets of European banking supervision is the capacity to compare banks' situation across countries through benchmarking, peer review, and horizontal functions. But challenges remain. One important impediment is the insufficient harmonization of the regulatory framework. Don't get me wrong, the current regulatory framework is definitely an improvement compared to the previous regime. We now have a single rule book and technical standards applicable all over Europe. However, this is still room in progress. For example, too many national options and discretion still exist in the European legislation. We identify more than 150 of them in the regulation which transpose the Basel III framework. We have undertaken tremendous work to make a difference on this front, and have proposed solutions to those national options that fall under the discretion of national supervisors. I'm pleased to say that in the SSM, we agreed on a single implementation of those national options in a rigorous fashion for most of them. We still have less than five that we have to address in a tougher fashion, going through the legislators, but that will be done. And this is a unique and necessary achievement which could not have been obtained in any other European forum. In promoting the rigorous harmonization of the SSM regulatory framework, we aim at aligning it with global standards, and when there is no such standards, adopting the most conservative approach. This is what the SSM is about: more consistency, more comparability, and eventually more trust in the European banking system. In this respect, we are a game changer. Maybe it's not yet visible, but I can tell you we are a very strong game changer yet. There is no doubt that we have all learned from important lessons from the global financial crisis. And I think the experiences on both sides of the Atlantic has been very similar. The US and Europe worked together on Basel III, which was a major step forward compared to the predecessor piece of regulation. Another good example is the countercyclical capital buffer for banks. In other words, Basel III introduced a macroeconomic perspective in the global regulatory framework to mitigate systemic risk. Basel III provided a good basis for the United States and Europe to improve their own regulatory framework. Of course, there are some differences, but the main point here is that we have all the same goal to construct a regulatory framework that will help prevent another crisis like the last one. We actually believe that good regulation and vigilant supervision will help the banks to be sounder, safer, and more successful too. To accomplish this on a global level, international cooperation and coordination is absolutely necessary. With Basel III, we define a global response to a global crisis. We can be proud of this achievement, but we are not finished. We work together in the Financial Stability Board and the Basel Committee on specific regulatory issues, and in supervisory colleges of our banks on the supervision of the global banking groups. This forum provides ample opportunities to share experience, information, and knowledge, but of course we still can improve the way in which we share information and learn from each other best practices. This is why I was in the US for the whole week visiting my colleagues in Washington and New York. Ladies and gentlemen, with the creation of the single European supervisor, we have put one of the key lessons we learned from the financial crisis into practice. Harmonized financial regulation and supervision will help ensure the soundness of banks, prevent crises, and support economic stability. As I noted, the SSM is still work in progress, but we are here to stay. And every crisis is an opportunity, as the saying goes, and the opportunity for Europe was to create the banking union to complement monetary union. The opportunity for the world is to strengthen cooperation at the international level. From my vantage point, I would say that we are on the right track. My fruitful exchanges here this week with the US authorities and with the IMF also attest it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that great introduction. You know, the thing about bank regulation is that it very quickly gets down into a lot of acronyms.
Yeah.
And and yet they refer to real things, you know, and there's nothing more important than getting the banking system safe and sound for Europe. So I'm going to dive right into one acronym because this is a knowledgeable audience and they're hungering to know exactly what you're up to. That's the SREP, the Supervisory Review and Evaluation Process. And I understand that you've signed off on most of the capital plans, the banks that need to raise capital, how much they need to raise and so on, for the coming year. The question, though, is a lot of those numbers have not been released publicly, and there have been questions about that. Some investors want to know whether the banks in which they own shares, for example, are going to have to do a big capital raising, and if so, how big? And they feel frustrated that they haven't gotten that information. Can you talk about what kind of standard you've been looking for? And I know it varies from bank to bank, but generally speaking, is it 10% tier one capital or what? And also, why the numbers aren't being made public?
Well, I understand why investors would like to know more and always more about the situation of the banks. And we are in favor of disclosure. But I don't believe that good supervision can be done under the spotlight. A large part of the SREP is the outcome of supervisory dialogue between the banks and the supervisor. And for example, if it's a private thing, we do not hesitate, even if we are not fully certain, to go for the higher number because, well, supervisors have a conservative bias. If all of a sudden we have to publish every single little thing that we are telling to a bank, we will hesitate because we will go for what we are absolutely certain, no conservative bias of the supervisor, because it's a statement about assessment of the possible riskiness of a bank. So it's a matter of balance. Some elements have to be disclosed, a lot of information has to be disclosed. But not any on every single detail of the supervisory dialogue. And I would like to take the example of the comprehensive assessment. We have published a lot of individual information and data after the comprehensive assessment, in particular regarding the quality of capital, the different elements of capital, the capital situation of the bank. I have been disappointed. It has almost not been used. 90+% of the information that circulated was about the 25 banks having a shortfall on how much it was, which is not saying much, really, because a large number of banks had increased their capital before the end of the exercise, not to have a shortfall. So not the most important, but still the important elements, the differences in quality of capital for the banks, that was out and that was not used. So I believe this is a matter of balance. And in any case, the supervisors are not deciding, as a matter of fact. In Europe, the Market Abuse Directive gives the decision to the banks. It's the management of the banks that decides what has to be published or not. Even if we were, well, of course, if the supervisors tell the bank that they have to publish, they will publish. But even if we were willing not to permit the banks to publish supervisory elements of supervisory dialogue, it's still in the hands of the banks to decide whether it has to be published or not. They are the ones implementing the Market Abuse Directive. This is also a question that has been discussed with our US colleagues, and I don't think that we are in a different position and situation on this. Regarding the standards and the amounts of capital, there are different kinds of banks in Europe. There are different banking systems in Europe and different kinds of banks. The only totally comparable across the Atlantic are the global SIFIs, the 30 global SIFIs of the world, 15 of them being in Europe and 9 being in the SSM are visible on small population that can be compared. So we are intensively comparing what we are doing for these banks and what the other colleagues in other countries are doing. And I can tell you what we are doing is really serious. If not the highest, still to be discussed, probably not the highest, but really serious and comparable with what is done in this country.
Okay, another acronym for you, TLAC, Total Loss Absorption Capacity. And Jeff Black in Frankfurt, who covers the ECB for us, helped me with these questions. So you're hearing straight from Jeff on this one. The concept of total loss absorbing capacity, of course, is, for those who don't know, is the idea that it's a buffer, so that it's the bank's capital, equity and debt holders who absorb the losses first before it falls on the public. And the level of TLAC, as I understand it, is still to be determined, and but that decision is supposed to be made by the end of the year, I'm told, and the question is where it's going to end up. The U.S. is looking for 20%. There's been some talk about whether it should be less. Maybe the Europeans want 18. I don't know. That's what I'm asking you. Can you tell me about that?
Well, as a matter of fact, the TLAC issue is discussed in the Financial Stability Board, where the SSM is not yet having a seat. So I'm not around the table for this discussion, but the ECB is with the Financial Stability DG. We indeed wait until the final, and the banks are waiting until the final calibration of TLAC to decide how they should address the issue, which is probably more difficult for European banks, which are not adopting the U.S. Normal structure of bank holding companies. So they will have to find solutions for that. We are monitoring their progress towards this achievement. This is for nine banks, the nine global SIFIs that I mentioned. It's a Pillar 1 requirement, and it can be topped up by additional case-by-case Pillar 2 requirements. But it's not so different from what we have in the European regulation, which another terrible acronym, don't even ask me how it should be developed, MREL, M-R-E-L, which is for all some kind of TLAC for all the banks, and is a case-by-case Pillar 2 requirement that will be defined by the new Single Resolution Board, the sister institution of the SSM. So the European banks will be ready, will do whatever they need to do for this TLAC. I have no doubt about that, but to have the final details on the capital plans, we need to see what is the final calibration.
Okay, thanks very much. Greece, that's not an acronym. Greece the country. you told me before we sat down here that you're actually very impressed by the quality of Greek bank supervisors, and they're very cooperative, they're very determined to strengthen the Greek banks. On the other hand, Greece has gone through a terrible financial crisis, and naturally the level of non-performing loans has risen. Can you talk about where Greece stands in terms of its NPLs? And I know that there's been a commitment to inject more public money into the Greek banks to recapitalize them. Who's going to get it and how much? And I realize you can't give me every detail of this, but to the degree you can discuss what's going to happen to the Greek banks, will some of them have to be shut down, for example, or merged into stronger banks?
Well, indeed, we have very strong colleagues as supervisors of the Greek banks. Probably it's what crises do to supervisors. You learn lessons painfully and turn into tough supervisors. This is what happened in my country after the crisis of the 90s. This is why we have been very tough supervisors since this period of time. And thanks to that, the Greek bank, before the current crisis, has gone through an in-depth restructuration, recapitalization of the banks. And the Greek banks enter into the current crisis in quite good shape. This is the reason why, in spite of a very difficult environment, very difficult situation that has nothing to do with the banks themselves, and that was comprising no more market funding, outflows of deposits because there was a risk of Grexit that was mentioned every day in the newspapers and everywhere. Because of the bank holiday. Try to imagine what it makes to a banking system to be closed for a large number of days, for weeks, have restrictions on the portion of their deposit that depositors can collect, exchange control. The banks went through this crisis. They were weakened, obviously. Any bank would have been seriously weakened. That's why they need to be recapitalized, to be as strong as they used to be before. Regarding non-performing exposures that you mentioned, obviously, when a customer of a bank is not able to withdraw money from the bank, he is not or she is not rushing to pay credits. But still, in spite of this environment, that's not the highest non-performing exposure percentage of the SSM countries. And this is recent. This is kind of technical to a larger part, and in my view, will go down. So we are conducting right now a comprehensive assessment for the Greek banks on a stress test to assess how much money they need for recapitalization. And that will be finished around October, November. And they will be recapitalized with European money. That's part of the agreement that was signed between European leaders and the Greek government. And the money is earmarked for the banks. I'm sure that it's helpful for the people that decide about those issues. To know that the European Central Bank is conducting this review in the driving seat, and that the money they will be investing in the banks will be for banks that are supervised by the ECB. And again, this is not a problem because we have excellent cooperation with our Greek colleagues.
Okay, I have just one last question before we turn it over to our audience, and that's about something you said in your speech, which was about the options and national discretions. You pointed out that there are sort of, I guess you could call them escape clauses written into that allow banks to get away with stuff. And that you're trying to close a lot of those escape hatches, and that you said you made a lot of progress, and that's something I hadn't heard before. I think you used the number of less than five. Can you talk more about what you meant precisely by that? There are fewer than five of these ONDs, or what is it? What's the situation there? Because it sounds like a great step forward.
Well, yes, indeed, we identify 155 such options. They are, in fact, options that are put in the legislation to address certain specificities of certain countries. At least this is what lobbying is selling to the legislators. But once it is in the legislation, you have many more countries that are making use of those options. So it's weakening the regulation and weakening the trust of the markets and investors in the regulation. We were obliged to decide because sometimes you have positive response to give. I take it, I don't take it. So we were the new competent authority that had to decide in November. We decided that maybe should not be priority number one because we had more pressing issues, but came very fast after November nevertheless because it was done during the spring. And we managed to find the rigorous to decide about rigorous option, not to take escape possibilities in 150. We paid a price for that in certain cases, not in all cases. In certain cases, we gave a little bit of time for the phasing out of the escape solutions, as you said, because there were legitimate expectations from the banks after the national decisions. There are a few ones, less than five, and two are really significant. That we, I could have had an agreement on getting it less favorable, but that's not possible. You take it, you don't take it. So that will be reviewed by the legislator. I can give you an example, the famous Danish compromise, which is about full deduction of the equity holding by banks of insurance companies' equity, which was something asked by the French banks, with the supervisors totally disagreeing, but they managed to obtain it at the last minute from the European legislators. They were not needing it, really. They wanted it to be, they were fully loaded, Basel III, or more than 10%. No need, just to look nicer. But it happened what happens with national options. As soon as it was in the legislation, it has been adopted by a lot of other countries, with banks of other countries benefiting much more than the French banks of these options. So they don't even look nicer, the French banks. And sometimes those new banks using them are needing it, which was not the case of the French banks. So this one is not fully fixed, but we will not give up. We will go on discussing with the legislature to find a solution. Another one which is significant, and not only in the hands of the supervisors, the phasing out for deferred tax assets for future profits that should not be recognized in the accounts and in capital anymore. For the future, it's fully fixed. There will be no new one. But for the phasing out of the old ones, Europe is far too generous. So we have to reduce this significantly. But it will be more helpful if auditors could do their own part of the job, which is to make sure that they don't allow in the accounts of the banks unreasonable amounts of deferred tax assets for future profits. When the banks have not been profitable for many years, and when the amount supposedly could use represent a very significant number of profits. So we are also trying to make sure that our partners, the auditors, do their part of the job. That would help us as well. We cannot ask them, we cannot give orders to auditors, but still I can mention it for when I have a good audience, and maybe that will help me.
Just to make sure, the two you mentioned, the Danish compromise and the tax loss carry forward, are those kind of two of the key ones that have not been resolved out of
the
150?
Yes, the three other ones, I must say, I believe it's two other ones. I don't even remember which ones they are, meaning that they are not significant, really.
Okay.
But somebody is really determined to keep it, but four of them, or maybe, whatever, the real important ones are the two I mentioned.
Okay, good. And now I will open it up to the audience. Who would like to ask a question or make a quick statement? Okay, here, right here, Giacomo Landi.
I work for a Norwegian bank, so we're a little bit on the periphery.
And I'm sorry, I just gave your name,
sure.
But each person, please state your name and affiliation before you begin.
Sure. Giacomo Landi with DNB Bank. Had an interesting discussion last week in London talking about the European banks from the equity analyst perspective. And we constantly have a discussion between the Norwegian and Swedish regulators in particular. They tend to be competing for who can be tougher. And it's interesting to hear our senior management talk about the differences in comparison between the banks and how actually they talk about capital. And I'm curious, you talk about the differences between the countries and Europe and how it's coming closer, but how confident can we be from a distance that really what we're comparing is apples to apples between the banks? Because even in Scandinavia, which is relatively harmonized, I think there's still some differences in views.
Well, first of all, I am part of my mandate is to deliver safe and sound, but also consistent supervision in Europe. And I cannot do that without harmonized regulation. So for me, this is a very important point. This being said, there are different kinds of banks profile in Europe. Obviously, the real comparable bank across the Atlantic, for example, on worldwide, are the global SIFIs, 30 banks. Below that, you have other important banks that may have different kinds of profile. They can be internationally active or not internationally active. They can be in retail business mostly, also in investment banking. And we have also a number of small banks under supervision. For example, the 19 countries were obliged to bring at least three banks under the direct supervision of the SSM. So for small countries in Eastern Europe, for example, the third bank can be very small. And obviously, we have to address the situation with a lot of proportionality, even among my 123 banking groups. For the other banks that are supervised according to our standards, but by national supervisors, we have many different situations. For example, for the 3,500 less significant banks, 50% are German. And it's a pleasure for me, coming from a country with a very concentrated banking system, it's a pleasure to see all kinds of banks, public banks, private banks, cooperative banks, mutual banks, small ones, medium-sized ones, bigger ones. And obviously, we have to be very proportionate and to address adequately the different profiles of the banks. That's why it's really a benefit to have the 2,000 national supervisors working for us. And in our supervision in Europe, we have joint supervisory teams for all the 123 banking groups. Part of this team, on the head of the team, is in the ECB. The maximum number of people in the ECB for the big banks is 9 people, but for a smaller bank, we may have 2, 3, 4, 5. And the rest of the team is in the National Supervisory Authority. But the head of the GST is not, most of the time, except when we just cannot do it for because we recruited a large number from a certain nationality or things like that. But for all the big banks and all the problematic banks and most of the banks, the head of the GST is not of the same nationality as the bank, so, which is another way of addressing the national bias.
Okay, next question. Right here, please.
Yes, good morning and congratulations on all the progress. Doug Peterson from McGraw-Hill Financial, S&P. I have two questions. If I look at the United States and our banking system, there's two differences compared to Europe I'd like to ask you about. The first is that we have much larger, more robust capital markets, and the size of our capital markets compared to the banking market are in a different proportion. And I know that Juncker is looking at a capital markets union. So I'd like to know your comments about the Capital Markets Union in particular as it relates to the bank's ability to raise capital, to manage their assets and liabilities through securitization, things like that. Second question, also related difference between the United States and Europe, is the deposit insurance. And I know that that is next up on your agenda, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about the plans and progress on deposit insurance. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you for your questions. Yes, indeed, that's a big difference between Europe and the US, the importance of capital markets. I don't think that we will move fast into a similar situation to the US situation, but we have to move in this direction. That's also something that we learned from the crisis. It's good to have different sources of capital, not only for banks, but also for the corporates. So we very much support the market union. We want this project to be ambitious. We are asking the people working on this to really be ambitious on this, market union. I think lessons also learned from the banking union, we need more harmonization in the legislation, regulation. We need a single rule book, a real one, with not too many national options. Obviously, none at all would be better. So yes, this is very much needed, but for the time being, and probably for a number of years, SMEs, for example, in the bank in Europe will be funded through the banks. That's also why the banks have to be safe and sound and able to make their job, which is funding the economy. Regarding deposit insurance, we have changed a lot and fast during and after the crisis. There was a last, well, normally a single deposit guarantee scheme is the third pillar of the banking union, and this will have to happen. It will be the last step for sure. We had a very important revision of the directive on deposit guarantee schemes and deposit coverage recently. With this reform, I believe that we are in good shape. But we should be ambitious there too. That's the last pillar, and we have to make sure that this is happening. But really, indeed, we do not have the name single deposit guarantee scheme, but we are quite close of having it through the concept. Still, the whole thing, the banking union, is in a transitory period, in fact, because SSM is in business, and fully in business, but my colleagues in the single resolution mechanism are a year after us, meaning they are doing this year the recruitment and the preparation of the steady state that I did the year before. And starting on January 2016, they will be totally in business. We also have an important tool, which is in a transition period, the directive on recovery and resolution. Part of it is implemented in 2015, and the full implementation will only take place in 2016. On total bailing, these kind of requirements, which are very useful, will be on the table in 2016. So this is moving fast, but this is not the end of the journey, I fully recognize.
Okay. In the corner, please.
Hi, my name is Haley Boesky. I'm with Bank of America, formerly with the, with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Thank you for the opportunity to have this dialogue with you. I spent a lot of time at the Fed working on non-bank financials. So I wonder what the status is or what the goals are for the SSM, the ECB, around SIFI designation of non-bank financials, so the designation process and the expectation for regulation of non-bank financials that are systemically important.
Well, this part, non-bank financial or largely shadow banking, let's say, is not in my territory. We are in charge of the banks, and our responsibilities are all the duties that are in the CRD4, not anti-money laundering, for example, not consumer protection. This being said, obviously, I'm still interested in non-banks and in shadow banking because this part of the finance is using the banks. All banks have exposures on those part of the finance. So we have a strong interest in having a strong monitoring of these entities. And there is a project to be adopted at the European level on shadow banking, and we are strongly, the European Central Bank, strongly supporting the initiative of the Commission to supervise the risk wherever they are, whether they are in a regulated entity, a bank or an insurance company, or if they are in non-bank financial institutions. So this is a work in progress as well.
Straight here. Yes.
Nicholas, Nicholas Brandt with Lazard Asset Management. Thank you for your remarks. With greater harmonization, I presume that there is considerable scope now for greater cross-border consolidation of the industry. Does the ECB have a view on the desirability of such consolidation?
Well, that's a very good point. It depends on the countries, as a matter of fact. In certain countries, there are not so many remaining banks, and one less might be a problem. But in a number of other countries, there are a number of banks, and some consolidation could happen. Obviously, there is a very good report of the European Systemic Risk Board, ESRB, which is a body in charge of financial stability and macroprudential supervision for all the regulated entities, banks, markets, insurance companies, and all the countries, not only the SSM, all the European countries. The secretariat is located in the ECB. And this ESRB draft a very good report on the point that you raise. Are there too many banks in Europe, and should something be done? And it responds positively to this question, and sometimes puts a very good demonstration on very good questions when a positive stance or too strong would have been politically delicate. At least there is the question, and when you ask the question, you know the response sometimes. So I would strongly recommend that you have a look to this. I think it was in June 2012 or 13, probably 13, ESRB report.
And there was a second part to my question. Does the ECB have a view on the desirability?
Well, the ECB, having the secretariat of this ESRB committee, yes, obviously. there are two parts in the ECB. We operate under the separation principle, the monetary policy part with their own economists and the supervisors. For the supervisors, obviously, the sustainability of the business models of the banks, of course, based on the profit drivers, has been one of our very important priority. We indeed believe that each bank in each category, in each country, should address the question, is my business model sustainable? And if the response is not yes, something has to be done. And we have this kind of dialogue with the banks. We are not shy in having this dialogue with the banks.
Thank you.
I'm going to see if I understood that last answer correctly. You were starting about the separation principle. Is there maybe a different perspective on the other side of the bank on these questions?
No, there is no different perspective. It is just that in Germany and in a number of other countries, and we are established in Germany, the separation principle between monetary policy and bank supervision is something very important. And it is very important in the SSM regulation. It's not the case in my country, for example. In France, we always had banking supervision in the central bank, and I never met really or faced a conflict of interest during my 40 years of supervision in Banque de France. But it's not about me and Banque de France, it's about what the European legislation and European legislators want. And there was a strong majority to have this separation between monetary policy and the SSM, which means that it might happen one day that on certain things we have different, let's say, sensitivities or sensibilities, or I cannot imagine that we could have different views, really. But for example, I can give you an example. When people are discussing the need for structural reform, for example, for having a separation between the investment banking business line or subsidiaries and the retail banking, we do not have different views. But there is one element that the supervisors add in the discussion, which is don't forget the operational risk you are taking when you are cutting a bank. So the structural reform should be a good reform on if it takes place on have a lot of benefits, because it's not a free lunch. At a certain moment, you are cutting banks or cutting activities, and it has operational risk. Mm-hmm. It's just an example of the elements that the supervisors can add to the discussion.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you. Right here, please.
I had more of a thank you. I had more of a general question. As you mentioned, the creation of the SSM is a relatively new development. Have there been any sort of surprising consequences, ripple effects, or pushback from banks in the past year?
No. The only surprise, at least for me, was that we are more different in the banking systems in the supervisory authorities that I thought. I thought we were closer, more harmonized. There are significant differences. Also, probably because of the crisis that hit differently the different countries and the different banking system. But it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we are all of us in this adventure of the banking union, single supervisory mechanism for 19 countries, and we have to do a good job for all the countries and all the banks of the 19 countries.
I'd like to apologize. I'm not going to be able to get to everybody's questions. We're going to have time for a couple more, but let's try to keep both the questions and answers quick so we can get a couple more and still end on time. Right here, please.
Hi, I'm Jean-François de Roche from Crédit Agricole, BCR. I have a question about, you are talking about level playing fields. So as you know, the U.S. regulation for foreign banks working in the U.S. have had to adjust to a number of U.S. regulations, which is creating pressure for us. Of course, there is the creation of the holding companies, capital impact, but not only that, also on the rating of our counterparts here, etc. Talking about level playing fields, what is your view on the level playing fields, not within the European banks that you supervise, but from the non-European banks which are doing business in Europe, where, I mean, from here, I don't have the feeling it's as harsh as it is here for the foreign bank.
Well, obviously, it's better to have level playing field on cross-border perspective as well, and this is why we are working together in the Basel Committee, Financial Stability Board, and discuss with supervisors. I do not have the feeling that there is a major problem in level playing field across countries or even across the Atlantic. We are also, now that we are bigger on with 19 countries, we are also entering into a world where we might be only the host of significant institutions in Europe, which all of a sudden just have a branch with us. So we will be difficult as supervisors in such cases, because we need to have a grasp the European regulation about branching is giving to the host country powers in anti-money laundering, which is not our territory, and liquidity, which is not so easy to follow through a branch. And for the rest, it has to be a significant branch, and we will be a tough host supervisors of significant branch. So I'm happy to consider all the perspective, and sometimes I understand what is taking place in other countries when they are host.
I'm enjoying your expression on your face there.
Well, you said to keep it short, so I will not follow okay. up on that, but I have a few points I can make. Yeah.
All right. Yes.
This one will be short. And again, thank you so much for being here, Rajan Cohen from Sullivan and Cromwell. There is at least an incipient concern today about bank exposure to energy companies and other commodities companies. We've had this movie once before, about 20 years ago in this country. And I'm wondering if you are seeing any concerns, if this is a focus as to the exposure of the European banks to the energy and other commodity sectors.
Well, obviously, this is something that we are following, like many other risks. In Europe, a lot of deleveraging took place regarding this sector. So part of the solution is already there, and for the rest, we review those exposures just like other possible risky exposures. That's the basis of the supervisory work, and we have not missed this point.
I'm going to take one last quick question. How about right here?
Thank you. Valentin Schmidt with the Epoch Times. I would like to know why regulators, as opposed to the market, don't like the tangible common equity ratio and prefer Tier 1.
Well, in my former capacity, I had a very strong, if not total, preference for equity, just equity, plain, basic, boring equity. Now, I must say, I recognize that it's a different world. We have this directive regarding recovery and resolution, BRRD, and thanks to the resolution tools, thanks to the bailing, this is a new world where there is room for all kind of capital instruments to address the need for bailing in if there is a problem, or the TLAC that was mentioned at the beginning. So I'm not less demanding regarding equity and common tangible equity, but I recognize that it's not enough in our current world, and the banks have also to build this part of their liability side.
Danielle Noy, thank you very much for your insights.
And before we all go,
thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.